Welcome everyone to episode 2 of the Instructional Leadership Show. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Bader, and our topic today is finishing evidence-driven teacher evaluations fast. Our focus on the Instructional Leadership Show is on helping you confidently get into classrooms every day, have feedback conversations that change teacher practice, and discover your best opportunities for school improvement. And of course, when it comes to the final evaluation process, the more you've been doing those things all year long, the easier your job is now at the end of the year. I think the administrators who really struggle to get their final evaluations done often are the ones who don't have much to work with because they haven't been in classrooms very much. But if you've been in classrooms a lot throughout the year, if you've kept up with your formal observations, but also made informal visits and had a lot of conversations with teachers, you just have a much better sense of where people stand, and you have much more to say about them beyond your formal written notes that you took during your formal observations. So our topic today is getting those evaluations done quickly. And anytime we talk about efficiency, anytime we talk about optimizing anything in the name of speed or in the name of efficiency, we get a little bit nervous, right? As educators, we are people who are about quality over efficiency, I think, most of the time. So this topic makes us a little bit nervous, and I totally get that we don't want to cut corners, we don't want to take shortcuts, we want to do right by everyone in this process. And sometimes that leads us to feel like we have to make this our whole life for the second semester of the school year, or you know, we just have to put in hundreds and hundreds of hours in this evaluation process. And I do believe that instructional leadership is your top responsibility. If you're a school administrator, if you're an instructional coach, if you're a district administrator, I am all about instructional leadership. But I have some more specific views on teacher evaluation that I think give us a little bit of permission and give us a little bit of room to find some efficiencies here. And I think finding the efficiencies starts with clarifying what our outcomes are. What are we really optimizing for? Because if we're going to trim the fat, right, we have to know what is the fat in this process so that we're not cutting corners. We're not cutting the part that really matters. So when I zoom in and think about the purpose of the teacher evaluation process and just boil it down to its bare essentials here, I come up with two goals for the teacher evaluation process. Goal number one, is that each teacher evaluation should provide an accurate rating of the teacher's performance, right? No surprise there. We want to evaluate teachers, rate them according to our rubric, according to our criteria, and we want that rating to be fair. We want it to be accurate. We want it to be reflective of the evidence so that every teacher is treated correctly by the evaluation process. We don't want to ding people unfairly. We don't want to underrate people, but we also don't want to overrate people. And, you know, I feel like personally, I never thought I did that. You probably don't think you overrate people. The statistics in our profession suggest that maybe we do overrate people. But at the same time, you know, we're not looking for a bell curve here. We're looking for an accurate rating of each teacher's performance. And if all of your teachers are above average, well, that's not possible for the overall profession. But if all of your teachers are above average, I don't have any problem with overwhelmingly your teachers getting great evaluation ratings from you if they're backed by the evidence. And I think that's the key to everything we'll talk about today, is making sure that what we are saying, that what we are doing is backed by the evidence and that we have the evidence on hand. The second goal that I believe the teacher evaluation process needs to accomplish is the initiation of appropriate next steps. Now, a lot of people are surprised to hear that one because they think, well, actually, I thought the teacher evaluation process was supposed to, yes, number one, rate the teacher, but number two, help the teacher grow, help the teacher improve. And I actually don't have that as a goal for the teacher evaluation process. Instead, we take a step back and say, the teacher evaluation process is not what's going to actually produce the growth, but it is what will initiate whatever next steps are appropriate for that teacher to grow. And I think depending on where the teacher is in their career and what they're dealing with and whether they're doing well or poorly and what the nature of their struggles is or their opportunities for improvement, you know, what specifically the nature of that is going to dictate different next steps for different teachers. And we tried to design these evaluation processes that are comprehensive and that meet the needs of everyone and that try to help everyone grow. But I really think the evaluation process is incapable of going that full distance because it goes in so many different directions there. So I think the right role of the evaluation process after that rating has been made is initiating the appropriate next steps for each teacher. And that raises the question of growth. We've talked about growth a little bit and how that's sometimes kind of worked into the teacher evaluation process. I personally was a principal in Seattle Public Schools, and our process for teacher evaluation was called the Professional Growth and Evaluation Process. So in the name of making it feel like a good thing for everybody, we actually baked that into the name of the process. We called it the Professional Growth and Evaluation Process. The system and the tools that we used were called the Professional Growth and Evaluation System. But I found that really those were two different things, right? Like you can take two things and stick them together and they can kind of stick to each other fairly well, but they really still are two different things, right? They don't truly merge and blend together. But I do want to address this idea of completing requirements, because this is one that bugs us a little bit. This idea that all this work that we're doing is just a formality, is just a compliance exercise. Like, we don't want it to be just that. But I would suggest that to a great extent, more than almost anything else we do in terms of instructional leadership, the teacher evaluation process is designed to be a formality. You think, well, that doesn't sound very great. No, nothing should be designed to be a formality. That's terrible. And I get that, right? I get the feeling that formalities feel pointless to us. They feel like, you know, we're just cogs in a machine and our true beliefs and our true motivations and our true efforts don't really get respected by that process. But we have to remember that the teacher evaluation process is not necessarily created for us, and it's not necessarily created for teachers. The evaluation process largely exists for the public and for the school district and for the superintendent and for the school board, so that we and our teachers go through a process to demonstrate in an evidence-driven way that teachers are doing their jobs and that we are doing our jobs as their supervisors and evaluators. And that process might not yield very great results for us. It might not help us grow very directly. It might lead to some things. It might be interesting. But often, we are not the beneficiaries of the teacher evaluation process. I think ultimately, the intended beneficiaries of the teacher evaluation process are who? Our students, right? We want our students to benefit from the process. And a lot of that comes in the form of a formality. Right? Like if we're evaluating people that we already know are fine, who we already know are good, or especially people who we already know are great, what is the point of evaluating somebody who we already know is great? What's the benefit for students? Well, there might not be much change as a result of that process. Students might not see anything different as a result of that process, but it's part of how we guarantee that we are doing our job on behalf of students. It's part of how we guarantee that there is a high quality teacher in every classroom. And if that feels like a formality, that is somewhat by design. Now, again, that does not awaken my soul. That does not stir me to rise early every day and go and be the instructional leader that I've dreamt of being for my entire life. Like that's not great motivational speech stuff, but it is a big part of how we convey that confidence to our school district, to the public, to our parents, and how we ensure quality for our students. But because it is a formality, a lot of aspects of this process are a formality, I am very happy to minimize the amount of time I spend on them, to zip through those formality parts as fast as possible, and focus on the good stuff. And as Amanda said, focus on the growth and not dwell too much on the formalities, even though there are a lot of formalities. Now, I am also a big believer that we've got to get those formalities right, right? It's not okay for us as administrators to miss deadlines. In some cases, it is a crime. Like, you're required by law to get your evaluations done by a certain date. Just depends on your state and what kind of school you're in. If you're in a public school, it may not be a very big deal to get your evaluations in by a certain date. In some schools, in some areas, maybe if you're in a private school, there might not be any rules at all about that. But I was a public school principal in Seattle, and it was a big deal. You get them in on time, and I never decided to discover what happens if you don't get them in on time. But I believe that we should meet those deadlines, because in some cases, bad things happen. And one of the bad things that happens if you miss deadlines and you're in kind of a, you know, a union area or a place where there's a very strong teacher's contract, if you miss your deadlines, then your ability to hold teachers accountable for their performance goes out the window, right? If you don't do the required steps, the teacher gets off basically scot-free no matter how bad they are. So we don't want that to happen. It's not okay to skip required observations. And this is one that I think is kind of a dirty secret of our profession, is that a lot of teachers are required to be observed and required to be evaluated, but they're not actually observed. They're evaluated without ever being observed. Has this ever happened to you where your boss gets busy and they're like, oh, I know you're fine, so I'm just gonna come by when I can and I'll write up your evaluation, I'll put it in your box. And really they never actually come by. They just kind of have a sense that you're doing fine, so they just give you a good evaluation. I think this happened more in the satisfactory, unsatisfactory days. It's happening less now that we are required to submit more evidence, right? That our profession is much more evidence-driven now. We have these four-tiered rubrics, principals are required to have more documentation now. So this is common, but I think it's not okay, right? If you have not been in somebody's classroom, it's not right to evaluate them and basically claim that you have been in their classroom. Now, I'm also a big believer in the power of informal visits. In fact, I wrote a book on informal classroom visits and the relationship that they have to the formal evaluation process. So I'm a big believer in the added value and the context that you get from informal visits, but I think we've got to cross our T's and dot our I's and do those required observations, do things on time. But this kind of stuff does happen. It is very common, and I think it's more common with stronger teachers, right? If you've worked with somebody for a long time, maybe you feel more comfortable kind of skipping some of those steps, but I think we need to really be diligent about this. One more thing that I think is not okay to do is to copy and paste from one teacher's evaluation to another's when the evidence doesn't fit. Like, have you ever seen that? And I've seen this before, where something clearly was written about another teacher that was kind of like me in some way. Maybe like they were also a young man, or maybe they were in my same department. I'm like, I'm pretty sure this was not written about me because I didn't do this particular thing that's in my evaluation, but it's fine. So I'm not going to throw a fuss. You know, I think we owe each teacher an accurate rating of their performance, and that rating needs to be based on real evidence, right? It needs to not be made up. Now, having said that copying and pasting when the evidence doesn't fit is not okay, I want to share with you a couple things that I think are okay and are actually a great way to save time in the teacher evaluation process. So this is my list of things that it's okay not to do. All right, so we've talked about some things that are not okay to do. Now we're transitioning to things that are okay not to do. Number one, it is okay not to provide meaningful, insightful feedback in your final evaluation. And I didn't clarify that on my slides here, but I'm talking about in that final kind of summative observation report. I feel like we feel this pressure to make that report meaningful and almost poetic. And, you know, like we want the teacher to cry a little bit, and, you know, be touched at how much we really get them and how much we really care about helping them grow. But we fall short of that, right? And if you fall short of that kind of truly inspirational final evaluation, I want you to be okay with that, right? Like, these are not designed to be meaningful and insightful things. They literally are a formality. So if your final observation reports, you know, you crank them out pretty quickly, the teachers take a quick look at them, sign them, give them back to you. If it feels kind of perfunctory and like a formality, again, that's kind of by design, right? The meaningful conversations are not happening on paper, right? The meaningful conversations, the insights about where to grow are happening face-to-face. And I think that's a very good thing. And when we try to translate all of that into some Microsoft Word document or online application that your district uses, like, you just lose that. So I think the really useful place to have those meaningful, insightful conversations is in person. The form is always going to feel like a formality. Number two, I think it is okay not to give the teacher something to work on in the evaluation, right? An evaluation is a rating. And teachers do their own growing. So as a result of your evaluation, the teacher should be clear on where they can grow, clear on what they might need to work on. But it's okay if they're actually working on that and they're goal setting and they're planning for how they'll improve in that area, it's okay if that is a subsequent step that happens outside of the evaluation process. And again, it really depends on what has been bolted together in your growth and evaluation process. Now, for me, as a principal in Seattle, we did have some kind of next steps specified in our form because it was designed to do both of those things. It was designed to be both a evaluation and growth tool. So sometimes you will see that built in, but if yours does not have that built in, that is totally fine. If you don't give the teacher something to work on in the formal observation, that is totally fine because there will be a time and a place for that. And I think the time and a place for that is future conversations and goal setting for next year. Maybe you do a year-end reflection. You know, what are you going to think about over the summer? What are you going to work on over the summer? I think that's fabulous. Number three, it is okay not to write a unique love letter to every teacher. And I have love letter in quotes here because we're, of course, talking about a professional love letter. We're talking about the kind of letter that you would use as a reference. We're talking about the kind of letter that you would use to nominate someone for an award. And I have read these. When I first came into my school, I read all the past evaluations that were still on file in teachers' folders. And some of them really read like love letters. You know, Mrs. So-and-so is, you know, God's gift to kindergarten teachers and the greatest who has ever lived. And it is an honor to even have her shadow fall on me as she walks by. You know, it's like, okay, yes, this person is great, but like, this is not a creative writing contest, right? This is again, a formality that should accurately rate the teacher and initiate the appropriate next steps. So it is okay if you are not achieving that level of poetic perfection. Save it for when you are nominating the teacher for an award. Save it for when you are writing a recommendation letter for the teacher, because as much as that teacher might appreciate that unique love letter, like, it takes a lot of time and they're only going to read it once and they're going to sign it and they're going to throw it in a drawer and they're never going to look at it again. So please do not force yourself to spend 4 hours writing a unique love letter evaluation for every teacher. The fourth thing that I think it is okay not to do, and of course you've got to check with your district, see what your specific requirements are. Number four, I think it is okay not to address every single evaluation criterion in detail. When we first adopted the Danielson framework, we were terrified and overwhelmed that all of those, you know, 24, 25, 26 different criteria were going to have to be addressed in like a full paragraph or a full page. And we're thinking, I'm not going to write like a 25-page evaluation for every teacher. How can I possibly do that? But if I'm going to rate teachers in each of these areas and provide evidence, it is going to be like 25 pages. How do I do that? What we eventually came down to was kind of picking our battles and saying, okay, we're going to address the four domains in Danielson. We're going to have a rating and evidence for each domain. And we're going to have a rating for each criterion and evidence if that rating was unsatisfactory or something like that. But we didn't have a, you know, like a full page for every single detailed criterion. I think we've got to kind of set some expectations with teachers, with our human resources, with our union, whoever your stakeholders are, and figure out, okay, how can we make this a manageable process so that we're not doing a 25-page evaluation for every teacher? So I really hope you don't have to do that. If you do, hopefully you've got plenty of evidence to work with, but check with your district. So how can we free up some time? I believe that this process is inherently time consuming. You know, even if you don't do the four things that I said it's okay not to do, this is going to be a time consuming process. So any time that we free up by being efficient, I think we need to use for those evaluations where we really, really, really need to focus on crossing our T's and dotting our I's. And I like to kind of mentally think about my staff and who is being evaluated this year and kind of what the issues are, and divide people into kind of an 80-20 set of groups. And this thinking comes from a very old rule called the 80-20 rule or the Pareto principle. And it's basically this idea that 80% of results come from 20% of efforts, and 80% of efforts only produce 20% of results. Just kind of a rule of thumb that shows up in a lot of different areas of life. If you're a classroom teacher, you might have remembered that like 80% of your discipline problems were from 20% of your students and things like that. This shows up all over the place, just kind of a handy rule of thumb. And the way I apply it to time and teacher evaluations is to say that 80% of your teachers should take up about 20% of your time, and 20% of your teacher evaluations should take about 80% of your time. So let's consider a couple of numbers here. Let's say you have 100 teachers, just for the sake of simple math. That means 20 of those teachers are going to take up 80% of your time, and 80 of those teachers are going to get the remaining 20% of your time. That means you're going to spend much, much, much more time, 16 times more time, on certain teachers' evaluations. And if we're going down the road of an unsatisfactory evaluation with a really struggling teacher, I think there becomes kind of an 80-20 rule within the 80-20 also. So let's say if you've got 100 teachers, 20% of them would be 20, and 20% of those would be 4 teachers out of 100. Right? So if you have 100 teachers, let's say 4 are going to be really in danger of an unsatisfactory evaluation in any given year. I think that's just kind of a good average. You know, at the end of the year, there may be 4 people who are really struggling, need to be on a plan of improvement, need to be on probation or something like that. Well, if we apply that 80-20 rule twice and say, okay, now that we've whittled it down to the 20% of the 20%, and we're going to spend 80% of our 80% of our time on those 4 teachers, how much time is that? Well, that's 64% of our time. We're gonna spend 64% of our time on just those 4 teachers. And that seems like a radical reallocation. You know, we're not just spending an hour per teacher, we're talking about spending the majority of our time on just a small handful of teachers. And you think, well, that doesn't really seem equitable. That seems kind of unfair to spend that much time on just a couple of teachers. But I think to figure out if we're being efficient, if we're achieving the right aims by allocating our time that way, we've got to go back to what those aims are. So I want to go back to the 2 goals for teacher evaluations. Number 1, an accurate rating of each teacher's performance. And number 2, the initiation of appropriate next steps for each teacher. If the appropriate next step for a teacher is a negative one, it's one that is going to impact their employment history, possibly terminate their employment, it is going to take more time. Initiating the appropriate next steps for a great teacher is easy, right? We give them a top rating. We recommend them to be a mentor. That's easy, right? It does not take a lot of time if a teacher is doing well, but the appropriate next steps for a struggling teacher, someone who maybe shouldn't even be working with students, that is an incredibly time-consuming process, and we have got to be willing to allocate the time, but we don't have infinite time. So what that means is we need to be able to reallocate that time from the rest of our evaluations, and we can do that roughly using the Pareto principle, the 80-20 rule. So where do we get that time? Where do we get that time that we can spend on those negative evaluations when we need to? We get that time by spending less on the teachers who are doing well. And I call this the Anna Karenina principle. And this is, of course, from Tolstoy's novel, Anna Karenina, which begins with the immortal line, "Happy families are all alike. But every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way." And what that means for us in the teacher evaluation process is that when teachers are doing well, it tends to look pretty similar from classroom to classroom, right? Like good classroom management is good classroom management. Good practice is good practice. Good formative assessment is good formative assessment. And our summary statements describing that practice often can be ethically copied and pasted. When the same description applies to multiple teachers, we can reuse it. We can ethically copy and paste. We can literally say, okay, if I'm going to say that Justin is a dedicated science teacher and his neighbor is a dedicated science teacher, and you know whatever the rest of that paragraph is, as long as it's true for both of them, it is perfectly fine and smart for me to copy and paste that. This is the most time-consuming part when it comes to the final evaluation writing process, right? Now, you've already collected your evidence, you've already gathered your notes, you've already observed. When it's time to do the writing, like this is the hard part of the writing, right? Because you can't just copy and paste from your notes. You have to come up with some statement that uses the language of your evaluation framework to fairly describe that teacher. And if you do that and you discover that that same description applies to someone else, copy and paste, and all you have to plug in is the evidence supporting that. And of course, that evidence does have to be unique and specific to that teacher. It's not ethical to pull evidence from other people's observations. But it is ethical to reuse any language that does apply to multiple teachers. We want to strive for reasonable fit and specific evidence rather than uniqueness. Again, we're not writing a love letter here. We are not writing a unique, award nomination letter for every teacher in the evaluation process. All right, so how do we save time with the Anna Karenina principle? This is what I call a kind of working hypothesis approach, or kind of a bucket approach. When you have teachers who are doing well, they have a lot in common, they have a lot of similarities between them. And what you can start to do, like let's say you have 30 or 40 staff members that you're evaluating, and you can do this with your admin team. So even if you have 100 staff members who you're evaluating, the truth is you don't have 100 different classroom management styles and 100 different levels of instructional skill and 100 different collaborative styles that you're commenting on. Your teachers are going to fall into just a few buckets or categories that you can kind of lump them together in. For example, for classroom management, you might have some people that you characterize as warm demanders. You might say, okay, Mr. So-and-so and Ms. So-and-so and Ms. So-and-so, they're all warm demanders. We have these other teachers that, you know, make your list who maybe are a little more loosey-goosey, but they're still effective. You know, they give students a lot of freedom. They give students a lot of ownership. So whatever your categories that you come up with are, make a list. If that those categories don't fit someone and that that person is still doing well, make another category. And for most people, you know, for most schools, you can do this with just a couple of categories in each major domain or area. What's not going to work though is the teachers who are not doing well are not going to fit into those categories. Because again, the Anna Karenina principle says that happy families are all alike, right? Good teachers who are doing well have a lot in common. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. And we're applying that to say that when teachers are doing poorly, they're doing poorly in different and very specific ways that we have to document. So they're not going to fall into these buckets. Now, if you get a lot of experience with that, you might also see some patterns in the negative evaluations, but often there's just something very specific and weird going on when a teacher is really struggling. So we're not going to be able to use this strategy with those teachers. This is really for saving time on the teachers who are doing well and have a lot in common. So you decide which domains you're going to address. Those are probably baked into your evaluation system. You're going to decide on the buckets or categories or types of teacher within each domain. And then you're going to reuse your writing when making the same claim about multiple teachers. And this is basically what Heather Bell Williams, one of our members from New Brunswick, said. She said, categorizing my evals into the folks who are all proficient and distinguished, and simply using the language of the Danielson rubric repeatedly. I add some examples from walkthrough notes, and it's pretty quick and painless. And again, depending on your teacher contract, you may be able to just use walkthrough notes. You might not even have to do any formal observations for more experienced teachers, just, you know, depending on your contract. So you've got plenty of evidence from informals, by all means, use it. And Heather is in classrooms hundreds of times a year and has a very small school, so she's got that evidence right at hand. And she says, this is really critical here. She says, that frees up more time for the ones I need to spend more time on. The ones that could be challenged or could lead to disciplinary action down the road still use the language of the framework, but I have to be way more careful that my examples support the language. Absolutely. So anytime you're writing an evaluation that is negative, that is going to possibly be contested or challenged, you want to make sure that you're using very specific language from your evaluation framework in your description. And I'll show you how to do that in just a moment. Another comment that came in from Dr. Luther McDaniel in Georgia. He said, I generate a spreadsheet with feedback from each observation conducted during the school year, organized by standard. Fabulous. When writing a summative annual evaluation for a teacher, I use elements of the actual evidence and feedback from their classroom observations and combine them into concise statements. This makes the feedback on the annual evaluation meaningful and familiar. And what I love about that, Luther, is that there's no surprise, right? They've already seen that evidence because you've already given them that feedback. So the final evaluation doesn't come as a surprise. So here is a resource that I wanted to make available to you. This is my evaluation organizer spreadsheet. You can find it at principalcenter.com/eval. And if you are a member, we'll send you a direct link to that so that you can download that. Principalcenter.com/EVAL We'll take you to that spreadsheet and you can upload it. It's an Excel file, but you can upload it directly to Google Sheets if you use Google Sheets, and it looks great. You've got different columns there for your process steps, like your observation dates, as well as columns for the different domains or areas in which you evaluate each teacher. So customize those, fill those in, and then to use the Anna Karenina strategy, you simply write in the names of your different categories or buckets. You see, I've got under classroom management, warm, loose, student managed, strict, and so on. You make up your own categories, and then any writing you do for teachers who are, say, warm demanders, you can copy and paste from one to the other, and then edit it as needed and add the evidence that you may need. And the last major thing we're going to talk about today is CEIJ. Now, this is from a book written many years ago by my esteemed colleague, John Safier of Research for Better Teaching, one of the giants in our field, came up with this idea of CEIJ in his book, How to Make Supervision and Evaluation Really Work. I've got a copy on my bookshelf, and this is just kind of one or two pages out of his book, but I love this acronym, CEIJ. CEIJ stands for Claim, Evidence, Interpretation, Judgment. And it's a way of writing an evidence-based argument that is bulletproof. When you write a CEIJ argument, the person reading it is going to agree with you. And if for some reason they don't agree with you, if they think you are wrong in your assessment, they are going to have a tough hill to climb in proving you wrong, because you have provided a strong claim backed by evidence, clearly interpreted and turned into a judgment. And very quickly, I just want to run through each of those elements so that you can use them as you write your final evaluations. So for each area in which you're required to evaluate teachers, you can use CEIJ to make first a claim. The claim is a summary statement describing the teacher's typical practice in a given area. And the key phrase in the claim is characterized by. So Justin's classroom management is characterized by whatever. Put in your claim there. The E in CEIJ stands for evidence. The evidence is multiple specific documented incidents and instances that support the claim. And the key phrase for evidence is, for example, on such and such date, and then you fill in your evidence. For example, when I observed Justin on March 1st, fill in your evidence. The I in CEIJ stands for the interpretation. The interpretation is a clear articulation of the consequences of the teacher's typical practice, for example, on student learning, school culture, or other relevant outcomes. The key phrase for the interpretation is as a result. So you might say, as a result of Justin's classroom management, students are able to blah, 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 or students are not able to whatever. The J, finally, in CEIJ stands for the judgment. And the judgment is simply the final rating of the teacher's overall practice in a specific area using the language and scale of the evaluation framework. And the key phrase there is, therefore, so-and-so's practice in whichever domain is best described as level whatever. So you can fill in the blanks there as far as the domain and the rating within that domain. So that is CEIJ. We've done some webinars and more in-depth trainings on that in the past that you may have seen, but it's great for any claim that you think might be challenged. And you want to make sure that your argument is tight, that your argument is backed by evidence. And if anybody disagrees with you, they're going to have to put up a very good fight to prove you wrong, because this really is a bulletproof format. And I'm thankful to John Safier for sharing that with the profession. All right, that is what I have for you today on the Instructional Leadership Show. If you'd like to see how some of this fits together, I want to encourage you to take our Instructional Leadership Self-Assessment. And this is simply about a six-question quiz to kind of rate yourself according to the criteria on the High Performance Instructional Leadership Roadmap. You can take that quiz and get a copy of the roadmap, our full rubric for instructional leaders, at principalcenter.com/ILSA, spelled like the woman's name, I-L-S-A, which again stands for Instructional Leadership Self-Assessment. And what this can do is give you a focus as an instructional leader, give you a place to concentrate your efforts so that you have the evidence you need from getting into classrooms, you're on top of the evaluation process, and you're able to use all of that, not just to help individual teachers grow, but to make decisions on behalf of your school overall, because you are so informed from being in classrooms, from talking with teachers, from using the language of your instructional framework, and just making all of that a regular habit, like some of the people that I quoted today, such as Heather. For more on evidence-driven teacher evaluations, feel free to check out our flagship program, the High Performance Instructional Leadership Certification Program. If you are a member of the Instructional Leadership Association, we would be happy to upgrade you to that program. And if you have a group of administrators in your school or district, we'd be happy to give you a group quote. And you can learn more about that at principalcenter.com/certification. You can also learn more about classroom walkthroughs in my book, Now We're Talking, 21 Days to High Performance Instructional Leadership, which is available on Amazon as well as Audible. The audiobook is now available on audible.com. If you are not a member of Audible and you want to give it a try, you can do that at principalcenter.com/audible. I've been a member for probably the better part of a decade now, a very long time. I'm a big fan of audiobooks, so I wanted to make mine available that way. If you're a member of the Instructional Leadership Association, we've also granted you access to the audiobook in the members area so that you don't need an Audible account. And if you're not a member, you can learn more about the Instructional Leadership Association at principalcenter.com/join. That's it for today's episode of the Instructional Leadership Show. This has been episode 2, Finishing Evidence-Driven Teacher Evaluations Fast. I'm your host, Justin Bader, and I will see you next time.